This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Do you consider yourself working class or middle class or neither? And why? Were we ever what we called ourselves, a classless society? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria, and we'll be keeping it classy, not classless though. We'll talk about the role of social class in Australian politics, what role it plays in your vote, how it relates to the rise of One Nation. We've long told ourselves, as I said, we're a classless society, perhaps in more ways than one. But was it ever true? And has your notion of being, say, working class or middle class changed over the years? Does it differ from what your parents thought? If you're a younger voter, do those class labels even resonate with you? Does working class mean what it used to mean, which was blue collar? And do politicians understand it when they do rope these terms into their slogans? Tell me what role a social class plays in your vote or how you see it in Australian politics today. Also this hour.
Don't you know it's magic? Hot baby, it's magic.
Yes, there's a big stoush in the magic community. A robot. Yes, a robot wants to be recognised as a magician. Perhaps our latest twist in our relationship with AI. Daryl is his name, and he's an AI-powered humanoid. He and his owner are fighting for his entry to the world's most esteemed illusionists club. Rejected just because he's a bot. Daryl could be the next big thing in the robot community. So I'm asking you today, who are the great robot entertainers of history? Who's your favourite? Is it Dexter? Is it, could it be Daryl? From Dexter to the Daleks to Daryl. 1300 222 774. Tell me your favourite robot in popular culture. Does it matter to you if it's a robot? Does a robot entertain you? I know Dexter was entertaining to Amber, my producer. She told me all about that today. Tell me your story. Can machine-made art ever approach the efforts of a human? Do you even care if it is entertaining? We will pull that out of our hats this hour. But next, are you part of a class? Which class is that? And have politicians forgotten about you?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
What has class got to do with politics? Do you consider yourself working class, middle class, neither? Tell me about what those terms mean to you. My next guest is arguing that across the world, political strategists have thought, look, class is becoming less important in how we vote because blue-collar jobs declined, union membership fell. The assumption is, well, that old class loyalties to being working class were fading. But does that lead eventually to the rise of far-right parties, parties like One Nation? David Peets is the Professor Emeritus at Griffith University, the Laurie Carmichael Distinguished Research Fellow as well at Griffith University. He's written about this. He joins me now. Thanks for joining me, David.
Thanks, Mary.
You are arguing that politicians have misunderstood the working class, or at least maybe redefined it over decades. What's the biggest misconception that you believe the political class has been operating under?
Well, look, I think the idea that the working class is just blokes in blue singlets doing manual work, because that's really the origins of the Labor parties and the Social Democratic parties around the world in the days when unions represented manual workers, and they were clearly the oppressed, and the Labor parties arose in many countries in order to organise those workers. Now, as Western societies have developed, blue-collar work's become less important, white-collar work's become more important, and the Labor parties have become professionalised, and they've had people giving them lots of advice on opinion polls and so on, and they're thinking, oh, well, with the blue-collar jobs declining, it's now class isn't so important. And that's apparent in the way that there's less of a difference between blue collar and white collar workers in how they vote, and that's been transmitted into saying, oh, well, class doesn't matter anymore. But what has happened is the Labor parties have tended to move away from the concerns of working class people, but the working class still exists. It's just got a different form now. There's a lot of what people think of as white collar workers, you know, burger flippers or people in call centres or whatever. They're not in blue singlets. They're not manual workers. They're definitely part of the working class. And their interests, the interests of the working class generally, have been set aside to some degree by Labor Party to be more concerned about going for what they see as the middle ground.
Mm. David, doesn't this risk conflating a couple of things, not just obviously the economics behind someone and how they define themselves, but also just what has become a cultural byword? Politicians use themselves working class in slogans. It seems to be referring now more to an attitude, a cultural identity that doesn't necessarily have to do with income, certainly has some things in some people's minds to do with issues like national identity, got to do with patriotism. Isn't that the confusing factor in all of this?
Well, I think politicians, they've tended to shy away from words like working class, particularly, well, it's most obvious in America. It's also obvious to a lesser extent in Australia, where for decades you wouldn't see anybody in the Democrat Party in America talking about the working class at all. They'd all be saying, oh, we're here for the middle class and middle America and to a lesser extent in Australia, middle Australia and so on. Mm. But they thought, well, we don't have to then. We're talking about a group in the middle, but the vast majority of people are workers in one way or another. They're working for people who own capital.
Mm.
And their interests have been less and less focused on by the parties. And so you have new groups like One Nation or UKIP and the Reform Party in Britain and so on, who've stood up and say, oh, we're going to use the word working class and we're here to represent you. And they're really sort of talking about issues that are not much at all about the way in which the working class are, you know, repressed or exploited or whatever word you want to use. But looking at migration and all those terrible migrants or blacks or whatever it is that are the source of the troubles, but they've been able to capture the imagination of these people because the Social Democrat parties and Labor parties have sort of ignored, they've set that stuff aside.
Mm. So those cultural issues being part of that label. We're asking people how you identify yourself as being part of a class. I'm speaking to David Peets, who's from the Centre for Future Work at Griffith University. David, as I say, bringing it back to Australia, you're saying that it's part of a global trend as well, but here and elsewhere, a lot of politicians would say, look, they're focused on cost of living pressures. Surely that is the policy that cuts through to all people who, as you say, are under these pressures, no matter what they label themselves. Why isn't that enough?
Well, because they're not really linking the cost of living pressures to the ultimate source of them, saying, it's because workers are asking for too high a wage, or migrants are coming and taking our houses and driving up housing prices and so on, and failing to recognise the role of profits, the role of capital in creating price pressures for all sorts of people. So it's an issue that affects everybody, but if it's not presented in the right way, then people don't understand it. They don't understand the deeper issues, and so they put the blame on somebody else.
Mm. Does this just indicate that working class is one of those really plastic labels that you can apply to yourself and just stretch it in whatever fashion you can to promote your own point, no matter where you are as an Australian?
Well, working class is certainly, it's an idea that you know, different people have very different ideas of what it means. And if you, according to how you ask people a question, what class do you see you're in, you'll get different answers if you, depending upon which options you put up. And academics will argue endlessly about what constitutes the middle class and, what constitutes, if anything, the middle class and the working class and so on. But I think, you know, ultimately the concepts have meaning. The meanings are contested, but the concepts have meaning. And the thing is that, you know, when you look over time, and this is, you know, what the article in the conversation last week was all about, the extent to which people in any country identify as working class hasn't really changed much over time. The proportion of blue-collar jobs has declined massively in most industrialized countries. But the proportion of people who say, I'm working class, has been stable, and that's because the way that, work is organized, although the jobs are different, the way it's organized is the same. You've still got people who are being exploited and people who are doing the exploiting and so on.
Exploited. I've just got this from Ali in Ocean Grove that seems to nail that notion. She's saying, surely class structure and definition centre on access to power and self-determination, and that shifts with time, cultural change, occasionally revolution. Does it come down to that, how much people feel in control of their lives, no matter what they are believing on the political spectrum, and whether they feel as if they have no agency or respect?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, and a relatively small group of people have the majority of resources, and everybody else is fighting for the bit that's left over. And if you don't have the power, if you don't have the resources, then that's what typically will make people think, I am part of the working class in one way or another.
David, it was fantastic to read your article. Thank you for joining us and kicking off this conversation today.
Thanks, Mary. It's a pleasure.
David Peets is the Laurie Carmichael Distinguished Research Fellow at the Centre for Future Work, Professor Emeritus at the Griffith Business School at Griffith University. Ken, you've called from Geelong. What did you want to say?
Yes, hello, Mary. I'm of an age where I can remember this debate going back into the early 1980s. When I was at Monash in 1981, I was doing politics as a subject, and David Kemp, former Liberal politician, is also an academic, and he put out the theory, the Bayes theory, that at the time he basically said the collection in politics was going and that people voted on Bayes. 2 years later, I had an election with John Dalton, who basically said the most powerful union in Australia was the AMA, which you wouldn't have thought would value with the class system, basically said because they never lose.
Right.
The final word on it probably came from Paul Keating, and he basically said, all that doesn't matter. In the race of life, always back self-interest because you know it's always trying.
So in the end, Ken...
This is a bit of a furphy of an argument, really, is that self-interest is the main determinant of anybody's voting patterns.
That's right, no matter what they call themselves. Thank you, Ken. Yeah, interesting to get that view of how it has changed over the years. It does seem to be a perennial. Arthur, you called from Yackandandah. What do you think?
Yes. If you go back in time, Australians had a much more even wealth distribution system, and the unemployment rate in Australia was less than 1.5%. I remember the government being thrown out when it went up to 2.5%. 5% is considered to be low nowadays, not true.
Right.
And we used to be able to, the wages were such that if you had a job and the unemployment rate was so low that everybody did, you could afford, you had to scrimp and save, but you could afford to have a house, a car, a family, and so on.
So back now, in the day, it didn't really matter about the working class, and maybe these days it means something different altogether in terms of that power.
We were the richest country in the world per head of population back then. And as the wages were whittled down, we dropped down the list, and countries that we used to support as third world countries and give a hand to passed us long since.
Arthur, you're right. The world definitely has changed, and we're part of that. Seems though, that we're part of a global trend to have more people call them, well, as many people calling themselves working class, but still leading to a lot of disillusion. Thank you, Arthur, for that. This also on text, class is a powerful internalised bias. Many people and groups define themselves based on how they identify themselves. Mike says, finally, someone is talking about class again. It's the only thing that matters. But for the past few decades, we've been sold that class isn't a thing. And that's how the wealth divide has occurred in these last decades. Mike also says, is it different, Mike? I'm not sure. Forgetting about social class is only benefiting billionaires and disadvantages wage workers and contractors. Tell me, keep joining the call line 1300 222 774. I'll try to get more calls about how class works with your vote. Also coming up soon, if you rent, I want to know what effect sudden rent increases have on your mental health. A new study has found that those large rent increases are associated with more poorer mental health. So while we talk about rent being about housing and economics, maybe it's also a public health issue. Jump on the line to talk about that now, 1300 222 774. We will get to that. But also, tell me about the great robot entertainers of history. I can see some people being already on the text line giving me their vote. The great robot entertainers of history, as one robot bids to become our next favourite magician.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Don't you know?
Johnny Farnham thought it was magic. We are talking about magic because Daryl, that's spelled D-4-R-Y-L, if you can get your head around that, is an AI-powered humanoid, the centre of a global stoush about whether he, as a robot, can be considered a magician. Tell me about the great robots that have entertained us. 1300 222 774. I said from Dexter to the Daleks. Someone has told me on text that Daleks weren't robots. Really? Tell me about that. Or is it Daryl? 1300 222 774. Just so you know, just let's have a little listen to Daryl. Let Daryl plead his case. This is Daryl in action. Here he is crashing a birthday party and planning to work his magic with the champagne bottle. Oh, we can't find that audio. We will find it, though, because you need to hear from Daryl. He's been refused as a member of the prestigious Inner Magic Circle Club for Illusionists. Joining me now to weigh into this weighty issue is Lee Cohen, magician and illusion designer herself. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Now, I know you're not a Luddite. You actually work with technology in the magic space. But what do you think about Daryl becoming a member of the Inner Magic Circle Club? Maybe you can start with how prestigious this club is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Magic Circle is, I think, the oldest magic club in the world. It was established in 1905. They have their headquarters near Euston Station, and it's an amazing place where you can go and see shows. And it's not just a place where local magicians meet. Magicians from all over the world go there to meet up with colleagues and learn new magic as well.
So it's a networking, even performance space, but it's also a clicky club. You have to be, you need to be a member.
You can come to public shows. So they do have public shows where anyone can go and buy a ticket and watch those shows. But in order to attend the inner workings and meetings, you do have to be a member. You need to be a magician and sort of pass an audition in order to gain that membership.
Okay, so this is the conundrum. Well, it's not a conundrum for them. They've already refused Daryl a place in this club. I want to hear from you, 1300 222 774. Tell us about the great robot entertainers. We'll get back to Darren in a minute. Jack, you've called from Yay. Who do you nominate?
Oh, yeah, good morning. It's the robot out of Lost in Space. He was always protecting young Will Robertson, Danger Will Robertson, Danger Will Robertson.
That's right. Not just an entertainer, but, you know, a good-hearted robot. I wonder if anyone knows the name of that robot. I would love to know.
B9.
What was that, Lee?
B9. B9.
Oh, you're all across it. You're well-versed in the robot world.
Yeah.
So, okay, I believe we have Daryl ready now. This is, so people know who Daryl is, this is him approaching, crashing a birthday party.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Hello, everybody. My name is Daryl. Would you like to see some magic?
Yes, please.
Concentrate on the champagne.
Oh, my God, look. Look. Look at the champagne. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Thank you, everybody. That's robot magic.
That's robot magic. So this is, you can hear the response of the humans around the table. They are thrilled. Here's this champagne bottle meters away from Daryl. He makes the cork fly off. Lee Cohen, why doesn't that qualify him to be a magician?
Well, I think the thing is that a robot needs to have a program that is operated by a human. Robots are sentient. I think that's really the difference there, that in order to create the effects, robots are just a culmination of everything that we know as humans. It's like a walking, talking Google.
Okay, all right, but to push back, this fantastic Inner Magic Circle Club, it already has one non-human member. That is, yes, you know it. It's a sock puppet. Sooty, the sock puppet. Now, if they can have a sock puppet, why can't they have poor Daryl?
I think there's a difference there. I mean, Sooty is nostalgia. We all watched him growing up doing magic tricks. Maybe
there's literally a human in the middle of him.
Well, absolutely, and it's definitely an acknowledgement made where they admitted him. That his handlers were part of that whole experience. I mean, maybe Daryl, in a few years when he's been around for longer, he can be a nostalgia element as well.
Okay. He's got to pay his dues. I understand.
Absolutely.
This. Tell me about the robots that have entertained you. 1300 222 774. I'm seeing, and oh, I can't believe I didn't remember this, one of my favourites, Marvin, the paranoid android from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the most depressed robot in the universe. Robots really have been part of our popular culture, Lee. Are there many robots in the magic industry? How revolutionary is Daryl?
Yeah, look, I think there's probably more than what you would realise, but in terms of being revolutionary, this level of sophistication with robots is certainly much newer. And robots are not shied away from in the magic industry. You can see all sorts of technology being used. I mean, David Penn is the, creator with Daryl the Robot, and he is known in the industry for working with mobile phones, magic, and all sorts of different things. Mm. You can see all sorts of different types of technology, you know, right down to lighting effects. And I think it's sort of a little bit misleading to think that robots haven't been part of the industry for a long time, because magic isn't just one thing.
Let's also hear from Daryl's owner, who does refer to Daryl as he. I see on text someone saying we should be saying it. Well, look, we're leaning into this illusion, if you like. It is a he. This is the owner, Daryl's owner, justifying why Daryl should be part of this magnificent club.
He's on stage. He's performing as a magician. He's moving people emotionally. He's amazing them with magic. He's creating empathy. And when he leaves the stage, he's getting standing ovations. And if that isn't a magician, genuinely, I don't know what is.
I wanted to play that to you, Lee, as a working magician. Obviously, it's interesting discussion to talk about how we as consumers and audience members respond to a robot. But how do you feel being a working magician, potentially hearing that going, oh, robots might be able to do my job after all?
Well, I think it is a really interesting conversation because, I mean, we have a whole magic festival here in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that.
Yeah, you can come and see what it's like in the room when people experience wonder. And I think that's really the key thing. How does a robot actually detect and assess that? It still needs a human element behind it in order to make that work. Yes, the robot is creating emotion and having responses, but isn't that actually to the emotion that's been programmed by the magician behind it?
We could go round and round this particular, wouldn't we? Terry from Drew and Reckons, it wasn't B9, it was B2. K9 is the robot dog as well. I think, what was the robot dog from? Was that from the Jetsons? Not sure. Danger Will Robinson. Jaime the robot in Get Smart. Oh, Jan,
yes.
That's a really good one. Lee Cohen is with us, who is magician, illusion designer, and will actually have a show on in the Magic Fest that is on from the end of this month, the 29th of June. Your show is called Enchantment Corner. Lee, what can we expect?
Yeah, so I'm doing a show called Enchantment Corner. We're doing micro shows for four people at a time. And there's some installation illusions, a bottomless wishing well. You can make yourself invisible.
What?
And there's a heap of, there's heaps of different types of magic at the festival as well. We've got international guests, people who have been on Penn and Teller Fool Us, international champions, all sorts of different types of magic for kids, adults, everyone.
Where is it on?
At Arrow on Swanson, so in the city of Melbourne, and we also have some events at Art Centre Melbourne and a few other venues as well.
Lee, thank you so much for helping us with this conversation. I have this on text as well, pointing to that underlying issue that I was talking about. It's not a fun, feel-good story. Why would we want to encourage infringement of robots and AI into more creative human jobs? It sounds like, Lee, as if you're not very worried about the future of humans in magic, just at this point in time.
I'm not, because I live and breathe this stuff. I work on big stage shows and I really see how much goes into isn't much danger of us losing what we do because they can't create that by themselves.
Yeah. Lee, you did an inadvertent disappearance act just there with your phone line, but I think we got what you were talking about. Thank you so much for
no
joining us.
No worries at all. Thanks so much.
Lee Cohen, who's magician and illusion designer. Her show is called Enchantment Corner, and Melbourne Magic Fest is on from the 29th of June. If, like that texter, and I agree with you, if we want to support the humans in the magicians industry, let's do that. Let's go to Magic Fest. Do I want to make myself disappear? Potentially. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We've been talking about robots and magicians. We've been talking about class. I'd like to get back to some of those texts that you've been calling, that you've been sending about that. Also coming up this hour, there's been a disturbing and significant national decline in vaccinations per HPV. I want to dig into that because that has been our great Australian success story. It was a vaccine we developed here. We were world leaders. What is behind that decline? But next, if you are a renter, tell me about your mental health. We're going to be looking at a study that suggests that rent increases, particularly the big and sudden ones, aren't just an economic issue, but a public health issue. Tell me about your stories.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Join me, 1300 222 774. If you are a renter, if you've experienced a big rent increase recently, what impact did it have on your stress levels, your sleep, your mental health? A new study suggests that it's not just our bank balances taking a hit when we are in that situation, it's also our mental health. Kate Mason is a senior research fellow at the School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne University. Thanks for joining us, Kate.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
What exactly did you find?
Yeah, well, it's become more and more common for renters to be hit with large rent increases during their tenancies. And as many of your listeners will know, if they're renting now or they've ever been a renter, having your rent put up by your landlord can be really stressful, especially if it's a big increase. And we wanted to understand and measure what impact that might be having on renters' mental health. And what we found was that when rent goes up by 10% or more, then on average, mental health gets measurably worse. And there were two groups that were hit particularly hard, and that was younger renters and people who were already paying a large chunk of their income on rent.
Right. So younger people and people with, I guess, lower disposable income. And what kinds of mental health effects were people reporting, and were they ongoing? Was that part of the study?
Yeah, we used a validated mental health scale. It's sort of a single score that pulls together from a series of questions that measure things like psychological distress, anxiety, and overall mental well-being. So it captures both positive and negative aspects of mental health, and it rolls that into a single score. So we weren't looking at specific dimensions of mental health. We were looking more at overall
And you're pretty confident that the rent increase was affecting the mental health rather than the other things in their lives?
Yeah. In observational studies like this, we often worry that results might be explained by, say, differences between groups that we can't account for, or, poor mental health already driving this. But a rent increase happens pretty randomly. It's not down to whether or not you've already got poor mental health or you're already, got declining mental health. And we were able to look at over time at people's mental health at times when their rent remained stable and times when their rent was put up. So we're actually comparing the same people within their mental health at different times in their lives. So we're confident that this is because of the mental health, because of the rent increase, yeah.
Mm. If you are a renter and those big, over 10%, maybe even smaller than that, rent increases have affected you, I'd love for you to share your story. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. You're listening to Kate Mason, who's been looking at that. Kate, a lot of people will hear this and think, well, it's a little obvious. You know, those sort of things can be stressful. What's the purpose of this study, especially, I guess, when it comes to policy making?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's kind of almost obvious that you'd expect to see this finding, and we weren't surprised by the findings. We were a little bit surprised possibly that it was concentrated in younger renters and not middle-aged renters, but even that, we might expect as well, because we know that younger renters are harder hit in general by unaffordable housing at the moment. In terms of what we should be doing about it, I think there are a few things. First of all, it's important for policymakers to know and recognise that large rent increases can harm mental health, especially for younger renters, and also for those renters already struggling to pay their rent. We've got about a third of Australian households who rent. That's been going up, and many of those people will rent for many years or even their whole lives. We have a lot of attention on home ownership, which obviously matters, but people are renting now and the majority of them are younger. And many will continue to rent well into the future. So renters' health really should be a policy priority.
Mm. So in other words, as I was suggesting, it shouldn't just be seen as an economic issue, it's a public health issue as well?
Yeah, that's right. And one thing we could be doing in Victoria that we're not now is regulating rent increases. So in Victoria and most other states, rent can only be put up once a year at most, but there's no real cap on how high it can go or how much it can be put up by. The ACT does it a bit differently. Their rent increases are capped at CPI growth plus 10%. So in other words, they have to be more or less in line with inflation. And there's other examples from overseas about different ways it can be done as well.
And is there any evidence, Kate, that those rent caps actually help improve, for instance, mental health outcomes, or is that part of the unexplored territory?
Yeah, that's still to be explored. Those policy changes haven't been in probably for long enough to be able to look at that closely yet, but hopefully that's something that we will be able to look at in future.
Mm. You're listening to Kate Mason, who is with Melbourne University at the School of Population and Global Health. If you've got a story about renting and how that's affected your mental health, please share it with us. 1300 222 774, the number to call. I guess, Kate, playing devil's advocate as well, and there'd be people in the audience listening to this who are landlords saying, look, their costs have risen sharply too. Of course, they're interested in the mental health of their tenants and so forth. How do we balance the interests of landlords and tenants? Does it come down to regulation, like you're suggesting, that takes it out of everybody's hands?
Yeah, I don't think we have to wait for policy change. There are more than 2 million Australians who are landlords, and the decisions they make about their investment properties can affect their renters' health, for better or for worse. Our study suggests that imposing large rent increases can be damaging for their tenants' mental health. Landlords obviously, though, have legitimate costs, mortgages, maintenance rates. But what our research says, that a large increase in the vicinity of 10% or more is a real shock for a renter who's already stretched. On the other hand, a small annual increase in line with other rising costs is reasonable. It's predictable. Households can absorb that. And indeed, in our study, we didn't see that harming mental health. It was really just those bigger increases.
It was only the bigger increases. The smaller ones are more manageable.
Yeah.
Amanda, you've called from Frankston. What did you want to say?
I wanted to say that it's so much more than just rental increases that drain on a tenant's mental health. There's things like wear and tear in the property, like what is justified as valid and what is, you know, going to ruin my rental record. And then also the security, every 12 months being like, do I have to find a new home now?
It's a much larger picture than just the money.
Absolutely. There are so many things that drain. And obviously, some things are just part of being a renter, but it'd be nice if Australia could look at things like long-term rents.
Are you renting now, Amanda?
Absolutely.
How long have you been renting for?
Since 2009.
And how do you think, how's that affected you, if you wanted to zoom out and look at it?
Particularly in the last 5 years, it's really affected us because we've lived in two properties that have been sold, even though we were assured one wasn't going to be sold. So it just really adds to that sort of drain of like, oh, we don't know what's going to happen every year. And it's, you know, very easy for people to say, well, save up and buy your own property. But that deposit is so unobtainable.
Amanda, thank you for calling. Really appreciate those insights. And Kate Mason was listening to that. I'm sure that's been part of your studies, Kate, that it is, there's a lot more to renting also that affects mental health.
Yeah, that caller's experience really captures what the data in this study is telling us and also evidence from other research. What they say, I think, really highlights that we need to be thinking about the health implications of housing policy and the way that our private rental sector operates. As you said, this is more than just a financial matter that has effects on people's health and their mental health. People are having to make trade-offs between paying the rent and covering other essentials. And when you have something like a big change, like a rent increase imposed on you without any control over it, that can also leave people feeling helpless. And that's known to be bad for mental health as well.
Mm. I note also that there's data out today saying that satisfaction with life among Australians is lower now than in the depths of the pandemic, and particularly hitting people between their 20s, 30s and 40s. Coupled with your research, Kate, it really does paint a grim future for renters, particularly if they're younger, if nothing changes.
Yeah, I mean, we're bombarded with information, aren't we, about how younger people, younger generations are doing it tough, especially in our unaffordable housing system. But there are policy options. There are other ways we can address this. And I think putting renters' health and wellbeing more at the forefront of that conversation is really important.
Mm. Kate, thank you so much for guiding us through your study today.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
That's Dr. Kate Mason, Senior Research Fellow at School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne Uni. This anonymous text, as a renter, what mental health? We've been talking about mental health in renting. We're also talking about class. What's that got to do with your vote? How do you define yourself? Emmy, you've called in from Hampton. What did you want to say?
Oh, hi, Mary. First of all, I wanted to say that my robot nomination is Dexter.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Please do keep those votes coming in. Sure.
I'm so sorry. I can hear myself in the background.
I think if you can turn your radio down is the key. Are you able to do that, Emma?
I'm so sorry.
Too hard to speak, Emma? We'll see if we can. I might hand you back to the producer. We can see if he can give you some advice then, because I'd love to hear from you. Let me just put you back on hold. Yes, so also we are still getting those robot votes as well. But this also about rent. A couple of landlords I know have said it's the agents that urge for rent increases because it increases their earnings. This another comment about landlords. I don't feel sorry for landlords who have increasing costs to them. It's a business. This from a landlord. I have run one rental unit. As a landlord, I used to not put up the rent when the managing agent sent a letter saying so. But if there's legislation that restricts the amount that you can lift it, I do now put up the rent. Because if I don't, I'll never catch up. So what do you think of that? If you are a renter, please join the conversation. Hopefully we will get time throughout the conversation hour to come back to that. It is the 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria Conversation Hour. Thanks for joining me. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about what seems to be a little bit of a blip to one of the greatest Australian success stories. That is, of course, the HPV vaccine. It was developed in Australia. We've rolled it out through schools. So why is there a significant disturbing decline in the numbers of vaccination? And it's an important conversation, particularly for parents, but for all of us to hear. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
The HPV vaccine was famously developed here in Australia. We'd had such good success putting it into schools and so on that we have a goal to eliminate cervical cancer, which it can lead to, by 2035. But will we reach that goal? Because it has been found in the latest statistics that the vaccination coverage has tumbled. Joining me now is Professor Margie Danchin, who is immunisation expert at Murdoch Children's Research Institute. Thank you so much for joining me, Margie. Or is it Margie?
Good morning.
You never know.
Yeah, good morning. Lovely to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us what the statistics show.
Yeah, look, it is a bit of a concern, to be honest. I mean, we've seen a downturn in immunisation coverage since 2020 for both childhood vaccination for kids under five, as well as for adolescent vaccination, and that's mainly HPV. And it's HPV is the one that's really concerning us because it's actually declined between 8 to 9% for teens turning 15 who are non-Indigenous, and for First Nations teens, it's gone down 15 to 16%. Since 2020. So we're now looking at coverage rates only around 75, 78%. And it's just devastating because we were really making such great progress in really lifting our HPV vaccine coverage and protecting girls and boys in Australia.
So,
and the decline is very concerning.
And part of the reasoning, apparently, is to do with now the number of vaccination jabs you get as a teenager. Is that right?
Well, that's right. So we now only give one HPV vaccine dose in year seven, which is great for kids. And it's very effective. We don't need two doses anymore. We used to give two doses 6 months apart. But what that means is if the young person is away on the day of vaccination or for whatever reason they haven't returned the consent form, there sort of isn't that opportunity in the school setting to catch up the next time the immunisation team comes back. And families are busy. Often parents don't know. They can go to their GP or the pharmacist even to get their young person vaccinated. So that is a real concern. And we're also seeing a lot more young people being homeschooled. Absenteeism has increased. So there's a lot of genuine practical barriers to why the coverage has slipped.
You're listening to Professor Margie Danchin, who's with the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. If you are a parent, were you aware of this being in your school, your kid's school, and did you make sure that your kid, if they missed it, did actually go back for that HPV vaccine? 1300 222 774. The reason why I'm posing that question to people, Margie, has there been some complacency, some lack of awareness even put throughout schools as to how important the vaccine is?
Look, I think partially. I think there is generally a bit of a downturn in awareness around HPV, and parents have questions. The young people themselves have questions why they need this vaccine to prevent, you know, cervical cancer, penile cancer, genital warts. It's not necessarily a nice topic. And I think we need to do better in schools about communicating to young people about their health and also to the parents about why this is needed. And it doesn't mean the young person is going to be more promiscuous or more involved or sexually active. It's simply the best opportunity for us to immunise young people before they are exposed to the HPV virus, which is generally transmitted during sexual contact.
Do you think really that squeamishness or, you know, prurience is part of this in 2026?
Look, I think for some cultural groups, yes. It is a sensitive topic. We certainly see that in a lot of Pacific Islander communities. But I think on the whole, I'm not sure that hesitancy or acceptance is the biggest issue. I think for parents, they're busy. Life is tricky after COVID. I think the school-based immunisation programs are not as well resourced as they used to be by local government. There's been a lot of funding pulled from public health. So the immunisation nurses are stretched. The schools are stretched. Not every school has a school nurse. It might be the poor admin person at reception who's trying to manage the consent form. So, you know, I think we've got some really good data now and evidence on all these barriers that I'm mentioning. So what we really need to do is design a more effective immunisation pathway that's better resourced to support schools and kids and families. I'm certainly not laying the blame on parents or kids.
No. This on text, Margie. My son missed his vaccine and I was told it was expensive to have. Can you advise us?
No, they don't have to pay. If they go to the GP or they go to the pharmacist, it's covered under the National Immunisation Program if the young person misses it at school.
There you go. So for that anonymous texter, you don't have to pay. And how old, at what age, if they've missed it more than just recently, until what age? Is it useful? Is it advisable to have that, Margie?
Well, we give it in year 7. I mean, in some countries, like in the Philippines, they give it in grade 4 to girls. Really, the goal is to give it before young people are sexually active. But if a young person, a boy or a girl, has missed it, they can absolutely go and get it. It's not too late. It's the best way to protect themselves against these cancers. And of course, you know, these are very slow growing long-term things, but prevention is what we need to be talking to young people about so they're not dealing with this years down the track.
It is so heartbreaking because I remember, you know, this fantastic, wonderful Australian-led revolution happened because, of course, of Professor Ian Fraser. He developed it here as a great Australian success story. I'm reading here, it's reported that there wasn't even one single documented case of cervical cancer among women under 25 across Australia in 2021. If the trend continues, Margie, what are we looking at?
Well, we are going to see cases of cervical and penile cancer. We're going to see more genital warts, which is just distressing for young people. It can affect their fertility. So it is serious and it is completely preventable. This is an extremely effective vaccine with minimal side effects. And I think, you know, what distresses me is we do have these fantastic resources. And in Australia, we're incredibly fortunate that they are free, they are funded. And so we need to improve awareness and access. It's always the access and the acceptance combination that moves that needle on improving uptake. So it's our job as, you know, academics and governments and healthcare providers to really get the word out there and encourage parents to help their kids get protected.
And just to remind people, this is really, HPV is hard to pick up, isn't it, Margie?
Absolutely, yes. It's transmitted during, sexual relationships.
Oh, the diagnosis of HPV rather than itself. There's no symptoms.
I didn't want them to think that the virus is transmitted in every sexual encounter.
No.
No, it's not so hard to pick up with screening. Screening's incredibly effective, but we won't go into that. But screening's also very important for young women.
Yeah. Margie, thank you so much for that public service alert. Good luck with your work.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
That's Professor Margie Danchin, who's immunisation expert at Murdoch Children's Research Institute. We are talking about that today. We've also been talking about the great robot entertainers of our time. Jaime, quite a few votes for them. John says, when I was young, there was a show on TV called Tobor the Eighth Man. Tobor is robot spelled backwards. I can't remember what it was about, says John. And this is the prize for thinking out of the box. Paul from Ringwood East says, my favourite magician is Bullwinkle. Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat. Now, try saying that in a normal voice. No, I couldn't, Paul. That was a good one. Now, here's something hope you really like. I won't be in the chair tomorrow. That'll be Georgie Coughlin. Join her and join me from Thursday.